Good evening. Hello. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the London School of Economics for this evening's event. My name is Dr. Rebecca Newton. I'm a senior visiting fellow in the management department, and I have the great pleasure of introducing our guest, Richard Reed, here this evening. So, welcome, Richard. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
As I'm sure many of you will know, Richard is the co-founder of Innocent Drinks and was co-CEO, and he led on brand identity for 15 years. He's also the co-founder of the Innocent Foundation and co-founder and partner of Jam Jar Investments, which is a venture capital firm behind businesses such as Deliveroo, Graze and Pop Chips. And after reading geography at St John's College in Cambridge, Richard worked for 4 years as an account manager in advertising agency BMP. And he started Innocent Drinks from a market stall. Is that really true?
100%, yeah.
In 1999, when he was in his 20s with two of his mates, John Wright and Adam Ballon. And what you may not know is that Innocent now produces over 1 million smoothies daily, and it's sold in 17 countries around the world. Richard was one of the leading figures, as you'll probably know as well, in the EU Remain campaign and presented BBC series Be Your Own Boss. And he is also the author of this book entitled If I Could Tell You Just One Thing that has... which is a wonderful book. I encourage you to read this. I know that that's what we're focusing on tonight, is hearing some of the stories and insights from the book. In addition to that, it has some really nice pictures, doesn't it?
Show the pictures.
Edna O'Brien. Yeah. Very nice. I'm sure he'll talk about that. In the book, Richard collects pearls of wisdom from some of the most remarkable and inspiring, game-changing people around the world. So to name a few of them, they come from across business, tech, philanthropy, politics, sport, art, spirituality, medicine, film, and design. And some of those people include Bill Clinton, Eric Schmidt, Dambisa Moyo, Mike Bloomberg, Karen Brady, Harry Belafonte, Tony Blair, Seb Coe, Richard Branson, Annie Lennox, Helena Kennedy, Nick Jones, Harvey Weinstein, Olivia Colman, and many, many more. I noticed that Simon Cowell's in there too.
He's my favourite. We talk about him later.
So Richard asked everybody the same question. Given that all that you've experienced, given all that you now know, and given all that you've learned, if you could pass on just one piece of advice, what would it be? So tonight we're going to find out. So in a moment I'm going to hand over to Richard. Just a couple of pointers on the housekeeping side of things. If you are a Twitter user, then the hashtag for tonight is LSEread. I would ask everybody please to put their phones on silent so that nobody disturbs the event. And this evening's event is being recorded, so that should be made available subject to any technical difficulties, but our intention is that that is available for you afterwards. As usual, after the lecture, we'll have time when you can ask Richard questions, so if you can hold off your questions till the end, we've made sure that a substantial chunk of the evening is where you can interact, and I know he's happy to take your questions. There's also going to be a book signing, so the copies of the book are available just outside to buy, and all of the royalties from the book sale go to charity. So I encourage you to grab a copy, and also Richard will be signing copies for 15 minutes afterwards on the stage if you would like that. But for now, I would like you to please join me in welcoming Richard to the stage and to deliver his lecture, which is entitled Lessons in How to Create and How to Succeed.
You came. I'm so grateful you came. You sort of do, you know, you sign up to things like this, you think, God, you know, you could easily turn up and be no one. So I'm really grateful. Now, why did you come? What do you want to hear about? Is it about what the people said from the book? Is it about the stories of how Innocent was successful? Are you more interested in business or general life advice? Why are you here? Yeah? Everything, right. So life, love, success, creativity. Right, no pressure. Fuck. Okay, well, let me put it in the context of the book. That's the title of the book, if I could tell you just one thing. The background to the book is that, you know, I can plot through my life 4 points where someone smarter, wiser than me gave me a single sentence of advice which completely changed the trajectory of where I was heading. And I can look back at them and see proper decision points where I went left when I was going to be going right, and left turned out to be the really smart call. So I've sort of developed a really deep appreciation of listening to people a lot smarter and a lot wiser than me, and trying to find what they have to say, what they have learnt. Because, of course, all our own life experiences are unique, but we are, at the end of the day, fellow Homo sapiens. And there are so many things that we can draw down from other people's lives and apply to ourselves, if we want to help us sort of improve ourselves, raise our game, get better to the goals that we're going after. For me, advice is essentially a nutrient-rich soup made from boiling down the bones of life. And so because I've experienced it and benefited myself so much, for the last 15 years, whenever I've met someone, either through business or after exiting business, I've worked in the government, I've worked in the arts, I've worked in charity. So I've been fortunate enough to be in the room with some pretty great people. And I've always gone up to them and asked that simple, single question. Sometimes I've known them, they've been mates. Sometimes I specifically asked them if they'd be interviewed for this book. Sometimes I just doorstepped them. I even approached one man at a urinal and asked him if I could speak to him and get his advice. And he said he'd be perfectly happy to talk to me, but could he finish having a piss first? So, I mean, I've been absolutely shameless at going after people, trying to find them and, you know, and basically just say, look, help, what is it you think that is the single most important thing? And as you were saying, it's actually a very wide collection of people from very different bits of life, because I'm interested in arts, I'm interested in politics, sports, science, spirituality, but also I'm interested in people who've been through not just the best of times, but the worst of times. The book has within it the really huge and big, powerful story of Lily Ebert, who is an Auschwitz survivor, who saw all her family being sent off to the gas chambers, but she was the one that survived. And so she's got an incredible sort of message to impart. And Colonel Andy Reid, who was an Afghan vet that had three of his limbs blown off and has made a fantastic sort of second life for himself. So he had really sort of important things, I thought. And Katie Piper, who is a brilliant authoress and CEO and model and also a survivor of a horrific acid attack. So she had really important things to do. So while I absolutely loved in this project, I get to hang out with Simon Cowell and fell totally and deeply in love with him for some sort of weird reasons that I don't sort of want to fully admit to myself. It's the best of times, it's the worst of times, and everything in between. But what I really did was sort of, then I stood back because of this lecture, and I thought, well, were there any patterns? Essentially, is there an algorithm to success? And I think the answer is sort of, there's kind of a few lines of code. I'm not sure it's a fully formed algorithm yet, but there were definitely some patterns in the chaos, and even people with very different life experiences, there were some sort of commonalities. And so I've sort of structured it around what I thought some of those were. There's 9. So I've kind of contradicted myself because it's the book's called If I Could Tell You Just One Thing, but I'm actually going to talk about 9 things. So there's sort of, you get 8 free. This is something I found to be absolutely true of people that have done exceptional things, remarkable things, is they keep the main thing the main thing. It's a phrase that we've used in Innocent a lot, actually. It's just about success starts with knowing what it is that you want to go after and having the clarity of thought that it's this thing and it's not all those other things. You know, success is about saying no 9 out of 10 times and saying yes to the thing that's most important, and then marshalling all your time and energy and resources, be it in business, be it in charity, be it in the military, behind serving that simple, single-minded objective. It's the drive of success behind the British rowing team. The German coach that came in and said, we're going to make every decision, both on and off the water, both as a team, both as individuals, both what we do in our days off and when we're here in the boathouse. We're going to make every single decision, how we eat, what we do, how we dress, the exercises we do. Every decision is made against one criteria. Will it make the boat go faster? And so it's having that simple laser-like focus, which seems to be one of the commonalities between people have been hugely successful. Certainly Johnny Ives, the head of design at Apple Computers, he was a guy that I doorstepped at a party. It's not like he's like, I can't make out most of these people are my mates or anything, but I was at a party and he was there, I thought, I've got to ask him, right? I mean, there is no one in the world better at industrial design than this guy. And what was his advice? When I said, look, this is the book and it's for charity and we just want to know if you're going to pass on one thing. He just went straight to it. He said, look, it's about just doing one thing. And then you have the audacity and the ambition to be the best at the world, in the world at that one thing. And he said, actually, that wasn't something that came naturally to him. He's a creative guy with a creative brain and he can think of 100,000 things to do. He said it was Steve Jobs that was absolutely brutally, religiously fanatical about focus on one thing. And he used to always come round to Johnny Ives, and this is what Johnny Ives was saying, he'd come round to his office each day and say, what have you stopped? What have you said no to? This focus on, you've got to stop doing stuff and just do one thing. So he told me this story, and it's really powerful. It's the greatest example ever of the benefits of focus. You know, Apple Computer, the most valuable company in the world. It's all about doing the one thing. And this idea of say no, say no. And then he confessed to me afterwards. He said he used to make up projects. So he would have something to say to Steve each morning that he'd said no to and stopped. And that's what I loved about it. There's another thing that you find of sort of people that have been, even the people that are really absolutely at the top of their game, and they would admit this themselves, everyone is still sort of faking it. We think, you know, we think, well, we're sort of normal and these are the superhumans, but they're not, they are us and we are them and everyone's busking. I mean, of course there's skill and of course there's application of effort and energy, but don't ever think that the people that we see in the media that are the sort of look successful, they're all unconfident. And that's why I found that a really sort of empowering, enabling thing to realise that don't wait till you feel confident. Don't assume that you've got to feel confident. Life is about feeling unconfident, but doing it anyway. You've got to just do what you can to fake it until you make it. And it's the very act of doing the stuff that you feel unconfident about that weirdly long-term builds the confidence in the first place. You've got to keep stretching that zone of comfort because you sit within it, it constantly contracts. It's made of elastic, so you've got to constantly push it. And if you're not feeling uncomfortable, then you're doing something wrong, or you're not pushing yourself far enough. I spoke to Michael McIntyre. He's the number one grossing comedian in the world at the moment. No one's making more money from making people laugh than this guy. But he's unbelievably unconfident about his ability to be funny. He said, and he used the language, he said he has his three yeses. He says he runs his own sort of Britain's Got Talent in his own sort of like little ecosystem. He needs his three yeses, his yes from his wife, his yes from his agent, and his yes from his mum. And if he gets those three yeses, they're saying, yes, it's funny, yes, it's good, then he starts to feel confident. And he says it here, it's like, everyone knows it's important to be confident. You can't just tell yourself to be confident. You've just got to build the systems around you. Do whatever it takes. It doesn't matter what it is that it takes. Another lady, Dambisa Moyo, is a brilliant economist and authoress, an African-American lady. She says, she literally just has to give herself a talk in the morning, each day in front of the mirror, to go out there and face it, to face the prejudice, to face the sort of the fear. And it doesn't matter it doesn't matter how you get the confidence, who gives a fuck, but just do what you need to do so you start taking those first steps. But don't ever put the pressure on you that you're supposed to feel confident about doing it in the first place. And even like Innocent, the whole thing, by the way, was totally faked to begin with. We used to go into fundraising, we were trying to raise funds, and we'd go in and go, we'd make the picture, we're going to set up this smoothie business, it's going to be great, and people are going to love it. And they're like, okay, so can we try the smoothies? And we're like, oh no, we haven't made any yet. And they're like, well, what are you doing, you idiots? I mean, you can't raise money for a smoothie business without having any smoothies. But we didn't know how to make them, we didn't have a factory, and we thought, well, we're trying to get the money so we can make the smoothies. And we realised it doesn't work that way around. So what did we do? We used to go in and buy Boots, right? Boots used to make an own label smoothie. I thought it was delicious. We used to buy it and we'd tip it out, put it in a bottle. The bottle, by the way, was our competitor's bottle that we bought and cleaned out with a label stuck round that we'd designed ourselves a computer and printed out, and around the back of it, which we never showed, it was stuck with just a tiny bit of sellotape. And we took those into the meetings. You know, who would like to invest in our smoothie business? We got the money. It was amazing. So you had to sort of, we faked it until we made it. And then, and then we're up and running, and it's great, and we're selling local things. And of course, you don't, if you want a big food business, you've got to be selling in the supermarkets. That's really difficult to get into, but we tried for 18 months, and we're doing everything we possibly could to get a break. And eventually Waitrose give us a trial listing of 10 stores. And we're sort of like thinking, this is so fundamentally important. If it works in Waitrose, then they're going to roll us out, and then we'll get into all the other supermarkets. And if it doesn't work in these 10 stores, we won't get any further. So then we spent ages thinking, well, what can we do to make sure it sells? What can we do to make sure it sells? We didn't have any money. So we think, we can't do advertising because we can't afford it, and we can't do sampling because we can't afford it. And we're like, why don't we just go and buy our own products? And I swear that's exactly what we did. So we just went and got all our money, we just buy our own products. And each one goes beep, beep at the till, and we're paying for it. It's like, it's fine, it's great. We're buying our own products, but it's showing that they're selling. And then we got from that 10 store listing, they put us into 40. And then from 40, we got into 100. And then we got into Sainsbury's. And I mean, look, I've sold the company now, so I can tell you all this stuff. But I think it's really important that we all express that, you know, you've got to allow yourself a bit of wiggle room. I mean, you don't want to do anything that breaks the spirit of things, but I mean, fake until you make it. Okay, third thing, obvious point. But, you know, I think, look, by the way, I'm not going to be telling you anything that you don't already know. Any of this stuff is sort of super obvious. But in life, you know, most things are basic and simple and obvious. But as I said, I've been very lucky to meet such a wide collection of successful people. And they really do come in all shapes and sizes, all ages, all ethnicities, all regions of the world. They have only two things in common. One is they all started whatever it was that they wanted to do, and the second thing is they never stopped. Other than that, the commonalities, they're not there. They're not a certain type of person. They're not from a certain type of upbringing. Some are very posh. Some are absolutely the opposite. Some are very educated. Some have never been to school. Is that they started and they didn't stop. So there is this fundamental importance of just get going. We started from the most basic thing. We had our idea. We didn't know how to set up a smoothie company. We bought £500 worth of fruit. We turned it into 1,000 bottles of smoothies in our communal kitchen, and we went to a market. We set up a market stall at a local music festival, and above that market stall, we put up a sign that said, should we give up our jobs to make these smoothies? And had a bin that said yes on the front and a bin that said no. Got people to try them and vote with the empty bottles, and we made a commitment to a group of three friends. If the yes bin was full at the end of the weekend, then we'd go in on the Monday morning and resign. And that yes bin was full, and we resigned. And then we had the sort of the white sort of panic of going, well, we don't actually know what we're doing. And that was the sort of a tough 12 months, but we'd started. It was just sort of get yourself in the game. And again, it's something that I heard time and time again from all the people that done stuff. So Baroness Martha Lane Fox, she started the dot-com revolution in this country, way before Google had even been invented, way before Facebook was even a thought. Her and her business partner, Brent Hoban, they set up lastminute.com. They were trying to raise money for a business where you bought things online, and all the venture capital funds said, well, no one's going to buy things online because no one's going to want to put their credit card details into websites. And it's unimaginable. She was setting up a dot-com business years before Google even launched. But her thing was just, you've got to be bold. And what I loved about what she said was, she said, look, the only thing you've got to lose is your reputation. And she said, well, who cares about that? And I thought, there's something really profound in that as well. I mean, yeah, I mean, who cares? What's going to go wrong if we try these things, right? Your family and your friends are still going to love you. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to die. I mean, or if you do, we're going to die anyway. I mean, there's sort of, just give yourself, we can all give ourselves a license to just give slightly less of a shit, right? It's fine. It's okay to try these things. So don't hold yourself back. Be bold. Go for it. Do it. All the people own this book, they did at least do that. They just thought they got started and they really went for it. And then, again, just sort of in a slightly more fundamental sense in terms of, now, Richard Curtis, right? He's got to be one of my favourite human beings on the planet. Not because he's a brilliant scriptwriter, although he is. You know, he's the guy that wrote Four Weddings and a Funeral and Love Actually and Notting Hill and all those amazing movies. But he's also, more than any single person really, has made sort of giving to charity, development aid, mainstream. He's the guy that invented comic relief and did Live 8 and the Make Poverty History campaign. So he's spent his whole sort of adult life sort of ducking and diving and harassing sort of governments and celebrities and every member of society in between to try and try to sort out some of the world's bigger problems. And he just said, look, you know, the world's full of people talking about doing stuff. And he has his own, what he says, his own personal motto, which is, if you want someone to do something, you have to make something. And he talked about, you know, whatever it is that you're trying to do, if you want to make something happen, you have to make something. Now, it could be a wristband. It could be a 3-minute film that captures a story in someone's hearts and minds. It could be a tagline. It could be a red nose. He said, make something. Just get started, but physically make something. If you want to make something happen, then you've got to make something. And his old advice was essentially about that. And if it, you make something that does also have this ability to sort of connect with people emotionally as well as logically, then you'd be amazed what can happen. But I mean, the guy is like, he was an incredibly powerful guy to speak to, because he was just saying that he feels it. Every single phone call he makes to ask a celebrity to be part of Comic Relief or whatever it is, when they say no, he says a piece of him is like really painfully dying inside, because he knows that if they say yes, they're going to raise more money for charity, and he knows that that money can save lives in other countries. And every time they say no, they realise that that's one less bit of solution that he's going to get hold of. So even from the outside, he looks like he's having such a lovely time. And he says most of his life is deeply unhappy because it's such a painful process doing it, but he's doing it anyway. So I loved his thing, though, about just make something. The world's a weird, there's weird sort of invisible forces that none of us sort of know or understand, but when you commit to doing something and you just follow this focused thing that you say is important to you, it's amazing. Just people come and help. I was amazed sometimes. I mean, in the early days, we'd be like unloading the vans with like all these boxes of smoothies and we're trying to get them into the shop. People walking by would say, do you want a hand, mate? People would like to help us unload the vans, just people walking past. It was just that this country is an incredible place to set up a business. There is such a background, latent, people want to help vibe to, well, maybe it's not just Britain, maybe it's everywhere in the world, but here, if you're thinking of doing it, I really recommend it. This is a great, great country to do it in. People will just want to help you. Not everyone, sure, but more than you might think. And there'll be a lot of proactive people, but as long as you're stood out there and you're being brave enough and courageous enough to say, I'm doing this thing, who's in? Another consistent thing across all of these people was there was always a constant sense of why they keep sharpening their swords, right? It's a never-ending process. It's never good enough. And again, this is all the stuff that your parents, that all our parents taught us, but it's so true. It's the practicing. It's not being born with the innate gift. The people that have really got to the top of what they're doing, it's because they just are doggedly determined and keep practicing and keep going. It was certainly what Andy Murray said. You know, he's got to be one of our greatest ever sports people. You know, the rainmaker, he ended the 76-year drought for Wimbledon twice. It was about practicing. Yeah, he's tall. Yeah, he's got good muscle mass, and, you know, there's a lot of tall people with a lot of more muscle mass than him. He broke it down. Because the weird thing is about him, he was good enough to be the world champion in any other era. He just so lucked out that he happened to be coming into his prime when there was three other kings of tennis. And what did he do? He didn't give in. He just went back and he completely deconstructed his gait and completely deconstructed his diet, completely deconstructed every single muscle. Train every little bit, practice every little shot. That was how he built that success. And it's not the people that are the most talented, it's not the people that are the most naturally gifted, it's the people that keep going the hardest, the longest, that are the most committed. They are the ones that tend to, long-term, win out. And it relates to that point, you know, it's not just about the practicing, it's about sort of, you got to push yourself as well. This is sort of, I mean, I've never met a woman that has pushed herself or exposed herself or risked herself more than this lady. Do you know her? She's called Marina Abramović. Does that name mean anything to anyone? She's the number one performance artist in the world. And she's now 70. And she spent 50 years as a performance artist. But doing the most insane things to her body, putting herself in unbelievable amounts of sort of risky situations. So one of her early works, she lay on a table in a museum in America, and allowed around the table was 70 items, including everything from a pot of honey to a feather to a whip to a saw to a gun to a bullet, and just let people do what they wanted to her. And by the end of it, she'd been stripped naked, had rose thorns prone into her stomach, someone held a loaded gun to her head until another person that was part of, you know, walking past the exhibition tackled him. And she was prepared to sort of just see what that revealed about our basic human natures, about how can you get descend to that so quickly? And so she spent her whole life sort of putting herself at risk. She did another one where she cut herself, she set herself on fire. She's done like the most insane things. And her view is, and I'm not advocating any of that, but there was just something really interesting about it. She said 100% isn't good enough. If you really want to, you know, shape the world, get somewhere different, 100% is not good enough. She said 150% is just good enough. And as I was talking about this, and I said, look, you know, but there's going to be people that sort of agree with the spirit of that, but you've been prepared to put yourself in harm's way in terms of pain, and most people aren't prepared to do that. And she said, well, look, pain is just something that you just have to address it, and you have to speak to pain and say, okay, pain, I recognize you, and I see you, and what else have you got, basically? So she's sort of like taking on pain. And she says, if you do that enough times for long enough, then you pass through the door into the pain-free state. And I thought to myself at the time, well, I'm going to have to take your word for that, because I'm not sure I'm going to follow that advice exactly to the letter. But I did like the spirit of it, the sense of be ambitious, go beyond 100%. Or Stephen Fry said it a bit more eloquently in a bit more British way. His thing, he reflected on all the stuff he's done, is like, at the end of the day, you know, you just got to work your bloody bollocks off. That was his sort of thing. But they all sort of, they all connect, they all relate. Another thing that was consistent was a sense of, look, we're all equal, right? We're all humans, we're all equal. And really, I think kind of the point of life is just to try and live a life that serves ourselves best, you know, that we do the things we want to do as long as we're not causing harm to other people and following those goals and dreams and ambitions. And a lot of people are advocating, well, this is an inside job. It's always an inside job. You have to have the bravery just to sometimes sit in a room by yourself in the dark thinking about what it is that you really want to do. Because actually it's a scary question. What do we want to spend our lives doing? Most of us don't actually have an answer to that question. It's fair enough. But that doesn't mean it's not a question worth reflecting on and trying to answer. And you're not going to necessarily get it every day. But I spoke to a guy called Shep Gordon. Has anyone seen the movie Shep Gordon, Supermensch? It's an amazing documentary about this guy that was basically the biggest Hollywood agent of all time. And he said that you've just got to sit in a dark room and work out what it is that brings you bliss. Shape your life around doing that. And most people I spoke to sort of reflected that in some way, that there is just a channel the fact that we're all equal, that we shouldn't be defined by expectations placed upon us. And I love what Nitin Sawhney, the musician, said, you know, don't be defined by your past or your future. Tune into yourself, work out now what is it in your authentic current self that you'd most want to be doing. And if you can somehow just always be getting towards that, life is going to be, from a deeper level, more satisfying. You'll probably have more courage to do more things that you want to do. And it really sort of struck me as it's something that people from art especially say. Edna O'Brien, one of the certainly Ireland's best and most revered writer, 86 now, just written her 22nd book, which has been... she's been called by Philip Roth the greatest writer in English currently. And she just said, you know, for her, she knew from the age of 11 she wanted to be a writer. And her parents were very controlling and said that she shouldn't and she couldn't be that. She had to be a chemist. And so she was sent off to sort of learn that, and she qualified as a chemist. And she's working in a chemist in Ireland, thinking she just allowed herself to get back to that childhood sense of ambition when she was an 11-year-old girl wanting to be a writer, and she started to do that. And So she left The Chemist and wrote her first book, and she's been writing ever since. And she said there's something about we've all got to just, in those still moments, just try and tap back into those things that we were thinking when we were kids. Never forget what bestirs you, is what she said. And I just love that. That's actually, I think, is my, out of everything in the book, they're probably my favourite five words. It's just a sort of a, it's a lovely sentiment of, let's just have the confidence, just give ourselves permission to think what were those things were and follow them. There's also thing about being unreasonable as well, which I quite like, you know, this sort of entrepreneurial spirit of, you know, we're British. British, there's such an inherent sort of sense of we're not really supposed to sort of, we're supposed to sort of just be very nice and drink cups of tea and not really say what we mean. And of course, that's great. I love this country. I really deeply do. My girlfriend's not British, by the way, and she just thinks we're mad because we just say the exact opposite of what we mean. And when we say no, we mean yes, and yes, we mean no. And you offer some biscuits and you say no, even though you secretly want them. And but these people that I met, they just tend to be like, look, you know, reject the choice architecture. Society is often saying, do you want the chicken or the fish? Well, sometimes the answer is, I don't want either, mate. I want the beef, or I want to leave the restaurant entirely. And, you know, there's just something about you don't have to take it the way it's served. You can question it. That was actually Heston Blumenthal's, the number one chef in the world. That was his thing about question everything. That's how he got to sort of be such a weirdo chef doing such crazy things, because he just started questioning everything. Why should ice cream be sweet? It was his first ever thought that got him into the madness of where he goes now, where he does chocolate that floats in pubs you can eat and has the greatest restaurant in the world. And it started with, why is ice cream sweet? And then he started making crab ice cream, and it got him to these different places. So he's thinking, if you don't question things, you don't learn. You don't push the knowledge. Where does imagination come from if you're not questioning things? And so most people I spoke to, they just had this healthy disregard for the status quo. Not deliberately upsetting the apple cart for the sake of it, but not just taking things as they were, because people saying, no, you can't. There was a lot of use of the word why. It's a powerful question, why and why not? But then people that have, you know, just Jo Malone. She said, you know, obviously she's a brilliant entrepreneur, and that's what she's first and foremost known for. But a few years ago, she got diagnosed out of the blue with a really heavy form of breast cancer. And a doctor took her, you know, brought her in and said, look, I'm really sorry to tell you, it's the worst we've seen at this stage. You've got the most aggressive form. There's nothing we can do. You're going to be dead in 9 months. And she said, you know, she internalized that for a bit. And she had this voice inside her going, no one tells me when I'm going to die. I'll tell you when I'm going to die. And she marshaled herself around that and started thinking about it. She said, well, and her husband gave this great bit of advice. And you should treat your cancer as a business problem. How would you do it as a business problem? She said, well, I've had a business problem. I'd go and try and find the best lawyers. And so she went to try and find the best doctors and did everything she could. That was the one thing. That was the focus then. She moved to America, found this guy who was at the cutting edge of oncology, went to see him, and she did chemo every 5 days for 12 months. It worked. She's now cancer-free. And going from being told she's got 9 months left to thinking, I'm not taking that. And again, Casey Piper, you know, a super smart, creative woman that an ex-boyfriend arranged for acid to be thrown in her face. She woke up in a hospital bed. She'd been in a coma for 11 days after it. She can't see. And she recounts that as she became conscious for the first time after 11 days, the doctor's explaining that, well, you've lost your face, you've lost sight in both eyes, and it might not come back. You've swallowed your esophagus, which is why you can't speak. The police are videoing you because they don't think you're going to survive to the trial. And she said, actually, her first impulse then was, I'll do whatever I need to do to get out of hospital so that I can get myself home so I can kill myself. But she said, weirdly, it was when, after 48 operations later, she was being checked out of the hospital to go home, and they'd arranged for a social worker. And she said, you know, she had nothing but obviously huge amounts of respect and gratitude for all the people that had been looking after medically, and for the social worker too. But the social worker started saying, so we've arranged for for some social housing, and this is your disability benefit you're going to get, and this is the disability vehicle. And she said it was that changed her mindset. She thought, why is everyone assuming me this? That's the best my life's going to be now, that I'm going to be in social housing with the disability benefit, and who says it's got to be that? And she said that was the moment when, in her parlance, she went from thinking of herself as a victim to as a survivor. And she said, I'm still me. I'm still the same woman that wanted to get married, to be a mother, to be a CEO, to be a writer. And this is 8 years ago. She's now married with a beautiful kid, has written 8 books, and is the CEO of a charity that's helped thousands of burn victims. And her thing was, because there are no barriers other than the ones we tell ourselves inside our own heads. And so this sense of you have to fight all the negativity, you have to fight the sense of things can't be done, or it can't be me, or it's going to be someone else, or someone's clever or smarter or funnier than me. It's all just nonsense that we tell ourselves. And we feel that the negative voices are the accurate ones, but that's just a wrong assumption. Negative voices aren't accurate. They're negative voices. They're the ones to be ignored. The barriers, as she says, they aren't real. We choose to keep them alive, or we can choose to kill them off. And she, of course, recommends the latter. Again, it's a cliche thing, but I was trying to express it as an equation. You know, where does success come from? Well, it is the idea of the thing that you want to do, plus the team of people you're doing it with, plus your skill at executing it. We all know that. And of course, then there is this multiplier effect called luck. All that stuff is added, then it's times by luck, where luck can be anything from 0 to 10,000. And there wasn't a successful person I spoke to that didn't spontaneously at some point talk about their lucky break, or something happened, or it went their way. And, you know, again, in a sense, a small example compared to what some of these people are doing. But, you know, of course we worked our nuts off, and of course we made some smart decisions, but we got super lucky with the timing of when we did it and the country being switched on to natural ethical food. And so I think the thing about luck is you've got to be grateful for it, you've got to be observant for it, you can't control that stuff, so definitely we have all got to focus on these 3 things because they are directly within our control. And then Anthony Bourdain, the chef, the guy that wrote Kitchen Confidential, he was a drug addict. He'd fucked up his career and his life. He wrote a one-off piece that got picked up by the New York Times because it was such a sort of diatribe, and they rang him and said, that was great, do you want to write some more? And he recognised this was, out of the blue, a shot. And he turned it into a column, and the column turned into a book, and the book turned into a TV series. And you just be aware, you know, we should all be aware of it. Luck can come at any point. We don't control it, but what we do control is our responsive to it. So if any of us get that shot of luck, then make sure you go, fuck it, all in, this is the moment. And then the final thing that I found that people always said, and I think for me, it's my favourite bit of it, is life is a team sport. You know, business is a team sport. Community is a team sport. Relationships is a team sport. You know, we are all the products of our people around us. And it was some of my favourite things I heard from people. You know, I spent 8 days travelling around Africa with Bill Clinton on an 8-country tour of different charity projects that the Clinton Foundation was supporting, and through our Instant Foundation, we were supporting some of them as well, so that's why we're on the same thing. And I saw this guy, you know, all the sort of, the reputation he has for sort of like, you know, dealing with people and looking at people and being with people. And when you travel with him, you realise this is not a myth. This is deeply, weirdly, brilliantly true, that every morning we'd get up at 7 in the morning, get in the convoy, drive for an hour and a half under some dusty track into the middle of absolutely nowhere of, you know, an African country since like Malawi, and that'd be to visit one of the community projects. And of course, for them, President Clinton coming to visit is literally the biggest thing that's happened to that community project. So they've got all the dignitaries there. They've got the local people doing a dance. So he gets out and he dances all the people that are dancing. He'll speak to all the dignitaries. He'll do the speech. He'll present the gongs. He'll go and speak to the mothers in the village. He'll talk to the kids. He'll notice there's one at the back that's looking particularly shy, and he'll make a point of going to speak to them. Every single person. And then back in the convoy, off to another one. 4 of those a day for 8 days straight. You know, in like the searing heat of Africa and the dust and all the rest of it. And what I found super amazing, as well as that, for every person, when he's with them, and it might not be for more than a few seconds, but he's just 100% with them. And then you get back into the hotel at night, and you think, blimey, if I'd be doing that all day, I'd be up in my room, getting room service, watching a movie, and he's down in the communal restaurant, speaking to the waiters, up at the buffet, helping people serve, American families coming up, like, amazed it's President Clinton, to go and speak with them and talk to them. And it's just, he absolutely inhabited this thing of what he said. He's thought the most important thing is people, and you've got to see them, you've got to acknowledge them, you've got to respect them. And to see a guy so inhabit and deliver and live the thing that he said was super powerful. And funny enough, Richard Branson, you know, he's sort of one of the world's most successful business people. But for him, it's about doing something you love with the people that you love. I've just come back from a month where him and Sam, his son, and Holly, his daughter, did a crazy month-long charity challenge where we had to get from Switzerland to Sicily under human power. So cycling 2,000 kilometres, swimming from Italy to Sicily, running volcanoes, all the rest of it. And he's built his whole ecosystem around him. He's doing the things he loves with his friends and his family and his old viewers. You know, you don't want to separate. People talk about sort of work and play, but it's all of it is life, and it's finite, and it's sacred, and it's special. So let's all think about how we can enjoy as much of it as possible. And the advice I found actually most profound was from this lady called Esther Perel, who's the number one relationship advisor in the world, and also number one sex therapist in the world. But the advice wasn't particularly about sex, but it was about, she just said this very simple thing about human nature, about our quality of life. And for me, life is about trying to make our life as sort of enriching as possible. So the single biggest determinant of our own respective qualities of life is the quality of the relationships of the people we have around us, our friends and family. Yeah, it's an obvious point, we probably already know it, but it was just sort of a really interesting thought to revisit. I mean, how would your life be if we all organized our lives and the decisions that we made were firstly against the criteria of, well, how am I benefiting the relationships of my friends and family? How am I being as generous a friend as I can be, and as a supportive friend and family member as I can be? And ultimately, it's motivated by self, because her view was, and she spent her career studying human beings and the relationships, is you then yourself get more out of life by acting in a way that makes other people feel that you're looking and loving them. And I thought that was a sort of lovely thought about sort of you improve your quality of life by trying to improve other people's. Anyway, so there's some of the thoughts that have come out. I hope that sort of at least raised a few questions or gave a few ideas. And if there's any thoughts you want to share or any questions you want to ask, then I'd be super delighted to take them. But as I say, if I was to leave you one thought over everything, it's like, I'm really grateful you came, so thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Richard. Okay, I'm sure that we have a lot of questions that people would like to ask. Before you ask your question, if you could just state your name and your affiliation, that would be nice for Richard to know. And please just wait for the roving mic to get to you. The attendants have them. So just over here, thanks.
Nick Fitzherbert, I'm just up. Guys, come along, so I'm interested. The obvious question, if I came alongside you in the gents, what would be the one thing that you would tell me?
My favourite bit, the way I think about life is that, in one word, it's to contribute. In any situation, life gets better if you contribute. Now, at work, your career is going to be enhanced by being the person that's positive and proactive and volunteers and helps and gets on and does stuff. And you, when you go around to your mate's house, if you're the person that contributes, you're sort of trying to help them do the washing up. And if we can all somehow find a way to give a bit of time or energy or money or old clothes to charity and contribute in that way. And there's just, as a simple principle of contributing,
a lot of energy comes from that.
Well, exactly. I mean, I'm a deeply selfish person, so I'm only really ever doing things that I think are serving me and my life. And I find that actually by contributing, I enjoy life more.
Yeah.
Lady in the middle. Next.
I've been impressed when you mentioned some people that basically they fight in order to improve their life or even to change things. But what's your opinion, according to your experience, when basically someone wants to change a kind of state of art situation that is injustice? So people that they need to fight against injustice that can in some way to give trouble to them. So do you think it's worth it?
So I interviewed two gentlemen, one called Dennis Goldberg and one called Kathy Kathmandu. They were two of the three men that stood trial with Nelson Mandela and were freedom fighters along him. And they were two of the three other people that were sentenced to life imprisonment at the Rivoli trial and did 28 years hard labor after a 30-year fight against apartheid, which they eventually did win. And I asked them what was their single most important bit of advice, and Kathy Kathmandu said that ultimately justice always wins. He said there may be colossal costs in the meantime, and there was for them, both personally and, you know, and for their country, but ultimately justice wins. And so for the battle against injustice is always worth it, no matter what the sacrifice, is what he said. And what I found so powerful, like speaking to those, like, I was thinking, where does the commitment come from to commit 60 years of your life to this? You know, 30 years in prison, the previous 30 years putting yourself at huge risk and completely and utterly having a life defined and shaped by it at huge personal cost. And he had his specific personal story was at age 22, which was in the late 1940s, he went to Auschwitz as a tour just after it had closed. And he said it was in walking around Auschwitz, where literally there were still human bones on the ground, that he realized that, in his words, the logical conclusion of racism is genocide. And when as soon as he had made that logical insight, he thought, so I cannot allow apartheid to continue and the embedding of racism, because that is where, if left unchecked, it can end. And so he said that's when he made this commitment, that he would then dedicate his life to fighting it. And succeeded. The lady in glasses had her hand up before.
Hi, my name is Tamar, and I'm a student at LSE, and Rebecca is one of my teachers.
Oh, so you're going to be a future Nobel Prize winner.
I hope so.
Congratulations.
Thank you. You said at the start of your lecture that there were four pieces of advice that you received throughout your life that really made you go left instead of right, and I was wondering if you could share maybe one of those or more with us.
Very, very, very happy to. They all, unfortunately, require a bit of a setup so you understand the context, and that will take too long. But one that springs to mind was when I found myself doing a job that I essentially started to not like, and I started to lose my confidence and didn't really know what the future held. And I went on a training course, and the guy called Patrick Maher that was running it spotted that I was in a bit sort of a negative frame of mind about everything. And he sort of took me to one side, and he gave me this bit of advice where he said, look, he said, what's the problem? I said, look, essentially, I think my job's bullshit. And he said, well, I'm not going to comment on whether your job's bullshit or not, which I totally took to mean that he thought my job was bullshit. But he said, irrespective of whether it is or it isn't, no matter how bad it is, there'll be one good thing about your job, if you really think about it. And he said, think of it as a sock drawer that in it has got 50 pairs of black socks and just one single red sock. If you open that sock drawer looking for black socks, you're only ever going to find and see black socks. But if you open it saying, I'm going to find that one red sock, you will find that one red sock. And he said, and the thing is, what happens is if you focus on the one good thing, even if there's 50 bad things, if you focus on the one good thing, you will just slightly improve your mental you know, how you're thinking about things, you'll just be a little bit more positive. You might actually then find a second thing that you like about your job. And if you focus on those two things, you'll start to feel a bit more positive. And he said, and I don't know how it works, but it's just a quirk of the universe that the world presents more opportunities to people who are positive. And he said, so if you go back and focus on the things you like and become a bit more positive about things, I promise you more opportunities will come your way. So I went back and I did exactly what he said. And I thought, there's one thing I thought wasn't bullshit about my job, was that I had one person to manage. And if I did a good job on that and helped them start their career, that felt like something I could take some sort of sense of satisfaction from. So I started to focus on that, trying to do that better. And that went a little bit better. And then I got asked to sort of, in the agency, to get involved in a new thing that they were starting up. And it wasn't for me, but it sort of relit a fire in me of saying, oh my God, people can set up businesses and things to do. And then it gave me the confidence to set up a little music festival, which I then did. And the guys I did that music festival with, one day we said, what about a smoothie company? And so for me, I literally know from him talking about find the red sock, we went bing, 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 set innocent. And then that has been the making of me in terms of sort of the most life-enhancing, exciting ride I've been on. So, yeah, I have find the red sock always as my sort of little thing that's in my head. Gentleman at the back, in blue.
Bob Tyrrell, alumnus of the LSE. A year ago, against my better advice, my daughter here gave up her job and started a food business. Actually, just got a listing in Boots. But anyway, my question...
My dad told me not to do it as well.
Well, exactly. So my question is, do any of the people that you spoke to have a consistent theme about the relationship between parental advice and parental support or opposition, or is it random? I mean, what's the role of the family in helping, supporting, hindering, kind of motivating their offspring to go and be entrepreneurs?
Well, it's a great question. I'm afraid I don't have it. I can't give you a definitive answer. I didn't see a pattern, but to be fair, I didn't ask that question too much. I think your job's just to worry a bit, isn't it? But also, I think it's about letting them know. So it's like Dr. Pepper. What's the worst that could happen? I mean, I think with setting up a business, right, it goes one of two ways. It either works, which is great, or it doesn't work. In which case, in my opinion, and as a guy that I've employed over 1,000 people through my time at Innocent, if I saw on someone's CV that they launched their own business, I wanted them straight in for an interview. Because it just showed guts and determination, giving it a go. I know the stats, most businesses fail. So you can't feel bad about one failing. You can feel about, wow, now I really know some shit. And that makes me more employable. And by the way, it makes me more likely to succeed the next time I do a business. So I think you either win big or you win later. But it's not the downside. Don't bet the family home because you will need somewhere to live. So, you know, make sure you've got a site where the mortgage deeds are and all the rest of it. But it's got to be better to be encouraged than not. But the truth is, she's going to do it anyway.
Up the top.
My father's biggest regret? Because, by the way, they were super supportive. They were just worried and nervous. My dad lent me the 15 grand I needed to start the business. And I said, do you want to take it as shares? Or as a loan? He went, loan. Bad decision.
Up the top as well, we've got some questions up here, Richard. The gentleman...
Lady in yellow.
Yeah, okay, lady in yellow.
Thanks. So my name is Erica. I'm an exchange student from Italy. I'm studying business. You said that it's very important to start something, but how do you get motivation to continue something and terminate it?
Well, I can tell you how I did it. I got the motivation by doing it with two other people. I never would have done it by myself. I wouldn't have had the confidence to. And even if I had, I wouldn't have survived the sort of the year of being told no by, because every person we went to try and raise money said no. Every manufacturer said no. It was just a big fat piles of no. So I wouldn't have got through that by myself, but I did it with two other people. So we shared the load a little bit. When one of us was having a bad day, one of the others would be having a good day, and they'd chivvy us along a bit. So for me personally, being in a little crew, that was super powerful. And it's what I was saying about the Michael McIntyre thing. It's like, if you've got it all internally yourself, then fantastic. But most of us don't. We need feeds in, and that's okay too. So just find the people to help you get motivated. It might be a mentor. It might be your parents. It might be the people you work with. It might be going on chat rooms. But you're allowed to not feel confident. You're allowed to be full of doubts. But just try and build a little ecosystem around you that's going to support you, because there are going to be tough times. There are going to be things, why am I doing this? It's not working. Everyone's saying no. And of course, not wanting to contradict myself, there is going to be some times when the right thing is to go, you know what? There's a better idea than this one. I'm going to stop this and do something else. Life is about, sometimes you've got to bang your head on the brick wall until it gives in. Sometimes you realize you can just walk around and go around the other side. So, you know, it's just be committed, but be clear-sighted as well. There might actually be some feedback worth listening to, that there could be a better idea or there could be a better way of doing it. But again, that's why I find it, if you've got a little crew of people that have got the same values and the same vision, then you can sort of talk it through with them and work out, are we doing the right thing? So yeah, as I said, you know, for me, the answer is typically always team. Gentleman in the middle.
Hi, I'm Andre. I study in Queen Mary's for electronics and music and audio systems, so I'm a little bit irrelevant here. But in your presentation, you've spoken a lot about confidence, about faking it until you make it. And don't you think that a lot of problems and common mistakes in the world in recent history, such as Brexit, economic crises, and Donald Trump, have basically been a result of bold people and not having enough bold people on the conservative side to counteract them?
Yes, in a way. Harvard Business School did this study where they showed that the more confident someone was, the more likely they were to be wrong. And if I was to give you a two-word example of that phenomenon, well, you already have Donald Trump. He is not lacking in self-confidence, but he's totally wrong. So for me, this is about... I think we're sort of saying the same thing. I'm always nervous of the people that are confident. I think the people that tend to have better sort of analytical skills and an ability to sort of see around problems, they're not confident because they're aware of the downsides and the risk. You know, I had an entrepreneur the other day. I said, what probability of success do you put on the fact that you're right? And he went 100%. Terrible answer. No one's got 100% chance of success at all. So the fake it till you make it wasn't sort of I was going to say it wasn't me saying lie and deceive, but it sort of is a little bit of lie and deceive, but only if you're... I've always done business in the line with the spirit of things. You know inside, deep down, if you're doing something that's fundamentally good or fundamentally not good. And I'm all for people that are trying to do something that's fundamentally good, but might be a bit unconfident about their ability to do it, or whether they should or shouldn't, or they've got this internal doubt about, am I good enough or not? That's who I'm talking to. Those people go, look, it's fine not to feel confident. It's actually good that you don't feel confident. And God's sake, don't let that hold you back from having a go. I'm really not saying we should all be like Donald Trump. Gentleman there in the smart blazer.
Hi there, my name's Isa and I'm a student of modern languages and theology. You mentioned a few factors at the beginning of your lecture which carved a way to your success, and one of them was spirituality. My question was how that played a role in your success now.
Well, I think to a greater or lesser extent, the answer to any question that we're each trying to answer is it lies within us already. And I think the sort of the spiritual side of life is just about finding a way to quieten oneself down a bit so you can listen to that. And I found when I built into my life an ability just to do that a little bit more, I could hear that very faint signal just that little bit more loudly. It's really funny, the philosopher Alan de Botton talks about ghost hunting. He says there's inside us are these ghosts trying to get out to tell us what it is that we secretly want to be doing and what we should be doing. And we've got to sort of like go with our, and try and find them and try and listen to them, concretize and bring to life those thoughts. So a lot of people weirdly said this sort of thing, that the answer lies within. But most of the time we're trying to just keep our neocortex brain in constant sort of distraction mode, literally flicking through screens just to keep that first bit, because it feels scary when I've got that distraction going. But I think one of the best bits of my advice my parents gave me is like, you know, get comfortable sitting in a room by yourself. Get comfortable being alone. And if you can do that, a lot of people find that really difficult. I used to. The idea of going to be in a room by myself and not doing anything. But if you just build that, just try it for 5 minutes a day. But build in time to let yourself speak to yourself. Listen in to yourself. Because we know most of the time, deep down, what's the thing that's going to serve us best. Should we go down at the back?
Hey, my name's Marcus. Earlier on you said that justice always wins. Do you really believe that?
Well, there's a couple of things recently are shaking my belief in that. No, I mean, yeah, no, I do think long-term, humanity shows that injustice does not survive.
Good.
But God, there's still a lot of it about.
Huh? I've come to this event just to meet you. I'm running a private prosecution case against some politicians that lied about Brexit on both sides. And we've raised some money.
Both sides.
We've raised some money. We've got some brilliant lawyers. And I need your help. And I'd like to talk to you at the end if you're available.
Yeah, well.
Wonderful. Thanks
a lot.
Good pitch. Book signed at the end.
One here.
My name's Amy. I'm also a student at LSE in the School of Management. And one of the comments you made was about keeping the main thing, was your first point. And I'm curious to know, assuming that you encountered a lot of creative types in your entrepreneurial world, when you knew the main thing was the main thing, because I think that I can identify with that struggle of the person that you were speaking about, who's incredibly creative and has lots of pursuits. So when in your journey of innocent did you know what the main thing was and when to stick with it?
Wow. Well, in a funny way, we had a sense of what the main thing was before we knew, before we'd created Innocent, the sort of, the brand. In our business plan, we were very clear it's about... We said it was all about making it easy for people to do themselves some good. That was what motivated us. That was the strategic choice. That was informed product development. And everything really came from that. And actually, if I can claim anything of Innocent, I can claim that. We never lost sight of that. That was the ingoing raison d'etre. It came out of the fact we were hungover. We felt lousy, and we were 26, and we did all the things you're not supposed to do and didn't do many of the things you were supposed to. We wanted to find a solution for modern urban life for people like us and to make it easy to do yourself some good. It was the language of the business plan. It's the language of the business since. The only bit that we sort of slightly contradict ourselves, but I sort of we added in the brackets afterwards, and do others some good too. And that's why, you know, the 10% of profits to charity and the environmentally friendly packaging, all the rest of it. So, but for me, it all felt like that was still congruent. It's all about, you know, it's a phrase that sounds negative. We're trying to do good. Like, you know, we don't make that claim because it makes it sound a bit pompous and self-serving. But yeah, we had a main thing at Innocent, and we kept sight of it. And I think that's what the thing that we thought and felt matched what we said and did and what we made and we packaged. And the congruency was really powerful. Not in a way that you'd notice on a day-to-day basis, but having that one thought really, really helped. Gent in the back of the blue shirt.
Hi, my name's Matt. I just came here to listen to you. I wanted to ask you about you said that you went into business with two of your friends, and I found your comments interesting about always being in a team. But I wondered if you had advice in going into business with friends, and if you think that you can always maintain the friendships.
Well, for us, you know, we're 20 years in, and our friendship's stronger than ever. And we left Innocent on a Friday, and on the Monday we opened up Jam Jar, and my desk is literally between Adam's and John's, to the point where if John puts his chair out at the same time as my chair, our chairs collide. So I'm like, 20 years later, I'm still in the, you know, I'm getting even closer to them in every sense. But the question is, how did that work, and why did it work? Because I'm very fortunate. One of the things I'm most proud of in life, I've got loads of friends, but I'd say most of them I would not go into business with. I can think of one other that I probably would, because I think what's really important is you have to be clear-sighted about the fact that it's about, do your skills, do they work collectively? And what was really powerful for us is that we had this shared set of values about how we wanted to be, which is we wanted to be successful in a way that we could be proud of. But the skills that we brought were very different, but very complementary. We all looked in complete horror at each other's jobs. I, from the beginning, was always, I wanted to be the guy that did the colours and the shapes and the pretty stuff and the making the drinks and all that kind of stuff. Whereas John wanted to be in factories, dealing with stainless steel pipes and trucks and lorries and getting things delivered. I'm like, oh my God, I'd hate to do that. And Adam wanted to go out and sell and do deals with sort of Tesco's and sort of be a man. And I'm thinking, oh, no chance. But they hated, so it made a really super powerful team. So complementary skills, shared vision, that was the thing that, because then what we're doing is then we're just accessing all the good bits of the friendship. Total trust, and trust is so efficient. If you trust people in business, then you don't have to worry about who's got the key to the till, and you don't have to write everything down because you trust people. So we could really trust each other. And secondly, we have this huge amount of awareness of each other's strengths and weaknesses, so we can sort of legislate for that and compensate for that. And thirdly, we could have total honesty with each other because we're mates, and mates, you can tell them the truth, can't you? And so, for us, the business was inspired by friendship. The business benefited from the friendship. And for me, best of all, the friendship benefited from the business. But it wouldn't have done if we didn't have those two things in place, the skills and the values. I think you were first.
There's only more questions coming.
I know, it's all like they're growing.
Yeah. A few more.
Hi, Richard. Thanks. First of all, so I'm Abhishek. I'm doing executive management from LSE only. And thanks for your piece of advice during the entire session. So that is the reason I don't want to miss this opportunity to ask a question from you. And although we have been talking around for all the success mantras here, what would be your advice for a failed entrepreneur like me? So I have couple of failures in last 7-8 years when I tried to start up one of the business, and then again another one. But now I'm getting a bit more cautious and how to probably go again, because I'm not letting that spirit down, and I cannot stand my job, to be very frank. So I again want to go and want to try it again, probably, yeah. Probably in different directions. But what would be your best piece of advice for failed entrepreneur? And did you also encounter one of the failures in your experience, other than Innocent?
Well, we definitely... No, Innocent worked from day one, but the first year of getting to day one was failure after failure after failure. So we experienced the sort of the being on the wrong side of rejection. And we came within 5 to 6 hours of losing the business entirely in 2008. So we made some catastrophic mistakes, but essentially, you know, the business was working. But we're aware of how relatively unusual that is. Most people's first businesses do not succeed. And I think there's a real truth in the fact that if you've presided over one and it hasn't worked out, all you've really done is you've increased the probabilities of the next one working. And if the second hasn't worked, you've even further increased the likelihood of the third one working. As long as you're being clear-sighted and disciplined with yourself enough to bank the learnings as you go along. So I don't want to be sort of, you know, minimize it. It must be bloody annoying, and you have got to think about, you know, providing for yourself and all the rest of it. But the great thing about entrepreneurship is you can do it at any point. I know some people have started their businesses in their 60s and they've gone on to be super, super successful. And but I'll come back to what I was saying before. Personally, for me, the biggest driver of success and the biggest driver of enjoyment and the biggest driver of motivation was doing it in a team. And then there was a fundamental thing that I don't know what your businesses were, but I'm on the receiving end of a lot of pitches these days. Most people, I would say, haven't really thought about the most fundamental thing of all, which is, have you actually genuinely made a product or service that is meaningfully better than the competition in a way that your consumer cares about? Most people are actually just doing kind of the same thing, not quite as well. And the world is going to just shrug its shoulders at that. You have to have something that creates a little bit of joy for a consumer when they see it, when they buy it, when they use it. And if you're not in the joy creation business, I don't think you're going to have a business. You've got to really genuinely solve a need, tackle a problem, make life better for the consumer, and more so than the other competitors that are trying to do that. Jen here in a T-shirt. Is anyone feeling like really pissed off? Has anyone put up their hand like 10 times and I've missed it? Great. So you're like people. Everyone's pointing at you. So you're definitely next. So anyone else want to nominate someone that they've seen their hand going up? And okay. You want one as well, yeah? Yeah. So what we're gonna do it about 30 times. Now you're just getting lippy. You're right. Okay, so you then, lady in pink, okay.
Hi, my name's Rory. I'm a student at King's, just down the road. My question is, I understand you're still on the board at Innocent. So where do you see the company in 20 years' time? Do you think it'll be bigger than, like, Tropicana, or where do you see, like, the growth?
Mate, it already is. It already is. No, we had this crazy, you know, when we set up the business, our thing was we wanted to be West London's favourite little juice company. That was really what our ambitions were. It was about having four small bottles. We had four recipes in little bottles, and we were trying to be the biggest juice company in West London. Then we made it London, then we made it England, and then we made it the UK, and then we made it Europe. And we had this goal that we set, you know, by 2016 we'd be bigger than Tropicana. And so I got a call from the chief executive about 2 months ago. We've done it. There's a massive picture of all the people in this big thing, like number one juice brand in Europe. So for us, that's a pretty big deal from when we set up just trying to sell to the delis in West London. But actually what we're trying to become is the Earth's favourite healthy drinks company. So there's still a long way to go. I wouldn't bet against the company. I mean, I think the best thing that's happened to Innocent in recent times is that we left. The company, over the last 3 years, it's done better products, more money for charity. I was in there yesterday. The vibe of the place is like off the charts good. And so, yeah, I think you have to have these ambitions. You have to go after these things. In 20 years' time, I'm hoping. You know, we aspire to be the Nike of sort of health drinks, basically. One brand that's in several categories, but united by a purpose of, you know, they're about bringing inspiration and innovation to athletes. We want to bring sort of natural, healthy food and drink to as many people and places as possible. So, and that's what everyone goes to work at for, because that's what they like. And there's a lovely sort of positive feedback loop. The more drinks we sell, not only we get more little healthy things out to people, the more money's been raised to charity. So it's like, well, let's do some more of that. And so, yeah, hope so. Right. The man that put his hand up 10 times and then the lady put her hand up 30 times.
That's cool, man.
Your name.
So my name's Carlos from Simply Scope, and I just wanted to ask, both in good times and bad times, what advice do you give to the founders you've invested in?
Blimey. Well, we had our first business fail recently. And you know, we did the same thing at Innocent, because Innocent had loads of things that, you know, failed, loads of products that you launched and all the rest of it. You've got to celebrate it. And I don't mean in a sort of, like, you know, false way. There's so much to be celebrated and respected. You've set up a business. You've stepped over that line and done it. I mean, that is to be deeply respected. And, yeah, and if it works, then great. But if it doesn't, then go into the world feeling proud that you had a go and knowing that you're stronger, that you're more employable, that you're more backable than you were before you did. So you haven't lost. You've just gained a greater potential for earning, for succeeding. I'm not trying to minimize it. It's painful, right? It's horrible. Of course you want people to be successful, but we don't. No one wins all the time. None of us do. Life is, you know, I don't turn into some cod psychologist, but life is a series of ups and downs and everything between. You've got to turn the negative into the positive picture. But a business failure is just a fantastic, so much better than going to Harvard Business School for 3 years and doing an MBA. Are you kidding me? You learn so much more by setting up and having a business fail. So, yeah, you've got to, it's all good, but obviously some bits are more good than others.
Saying that, would you put more money into that business?
No, it failed. Yeah, but it was right to fail. They misunderstood. The consumers didn't want the product. You don't back. You know, if it's, as I said, you've got to really believe you're making consumers' lives better. It wasn't that, and they weren't. We gave them a shot, and yeah, we had a brilliant ending with them, and we celebrated them. We're like, let us know when you're doing your next thing. But yeah, you've got to be clear-sighted as well. No one benefits from supporting businesses that aren't putting their consumers, you know, first. Lady in pink.
Hey, Esther Samuels, editor, and I founded a business this year. Sorry for being lippy before.
No, I'm joking. It's great.
After 30 times, I've now got two questions.
Oh, right. Now you're taking the piss.
I gained one after like 10 hand raises. First question is, how important, it's a business question, how important is the name of the product or company? And secondly, the penultimate question you answered, and you said that a mistake is that people are just doing the same thing that other people are doing, just not differently. So at the beginning, when you weren't able to give as much to charity and things, what did you do at Innocent that really set your success up? What were you doing differently to other smoothie makers? So, yeah, two questions.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, you've touched on a personal sort of favourite topic of mine, which is about company names. So when anyone comes in and pitches at Jam Jar, I always ask them, why you called what you called? And I have a personal belief, and I'm not saying I'm right, but I think it's better when your name communicates something that is relevant to your product or business or consumer. And it's absolutely fine if it doesn't. There's plenty of great businesses with bad names, and there's plenty of businesses with great names but that turn out to be terrible businesses. So getting the name right is not some sort of trump card that's going to get you a great result. But if you do get it right, it can help. And my pitch is this, and it will have cost you nothing. Everything in business can be plot on a 2x2 grid of how much has it cost, or how much complexity or cost has it brought, and how much value has it created. Getting the name right costs nothing. You've just got to have thought it and had the right bit of thinking and had the right idea. But it can really create value, especially if it's something that You know, we invested in a business recently called FarmDrop, right? What does FarmDrop do? Well, it delivers fresh food right from the farm straight to your door. Now, I bet if I asked you in 2 weeks' time, what does FarmDrop do? You're going to remember, because it's called FarmDrop, and it drops stuff from the farm at your door. We've seen other businesses where the name doesn't mean anything, or in fact, it's starting to mean sort of like, almost like the counter thing of what they're trying to say. And you think, I took a meeting from a lady who was pitching a lesbian dating app. Of course I'm going to take a meeting from someone who's doing a lesbian dating app, right? But it's a fast, high-growth market. You can see the huge potential for it. It's like, you know, it's the sort of thing that we want to back. And it's genuinely, and we love business to make life better for people. And anything that allows people to meet people and have relationships, that's our kind of thing, right? The name. Datch? I just thought, why is it Datch? Terrible name, no? It sounds a bit Butch or Datch. And we said, look, you know, we love you. We love the opportunity. We love the purpose. We love the business model. But Datch? She was like, oh, I quite like it, you know. I'm like, yeah, but why? And there wasn't even a reason why it was called Datch. She just thought it sounded good. I'm like, I don't think it's... I mean, look, I mean, obviously I'm not the target market, but I don't think it sounds good.
Were you called in a...
She got in touch with me recently. She said, we've changed the name to Her. I thought, brilliant. Isn't that a better name for a lesbian dating hatch? Her. Better than Datch, anyway. So I think, you know, it costs nothing. You might as well get it right. It's not going to change outcome, but it might make things a little bit easier, a bit more memorable. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're trying to catch someone's attention. And, by the way, none of us care, because what we're really thinking about is what's for tea and who do I fancy? We're not trying to remember a billion different brand names. So you've got to at least make it memorable and distinctive and I'd have it communicate. And what was the second question?
So were you called innocent when you went to Waitrose at the beginning?
Yeah, yeah.
Right at the beginning?
Yeah, yeah.
The second question was, at the beginning, what was it? Because there were lots of smoothies on the market, even in the supermarket that you...
What did you
were
do
using?
Yeah, yeah.
What did you do?
Yeah, because my thing is, you know, you can definitely do the same but better, but you can't do the same but not better, right? Most businesses are actually the same thing done better. Like, you know, all those crisp brands that come out, you know, like Kettle's Crisps. They didn't invent crisps. They just, like, made delicious crunchy crisps rather than sort of weird soggy ones. We did not invent smoothies. They're innocent. But they were different. The first point of difference was, compared to the company that was existing, it was called Pete and Johnny's, that had been making smoothies for 4 years before we launched. They were made from concentrated juices. We were made from fresh juices. Now, that's not just some sort of manufacturing, internally focused thing. That means two things. They taste better, and they've got more nutrition. The two reasons why people buy smoothies, for the taste and for the health benefits. So we're more tasty and we're more healthy for objective reason, that we're not using this weird industrial glue, but using freshly squeezed orange juice instead. Secondly, then we had a brand that communicated what we stood for, because our pitch was we're going to be natural and fresh and unadulterated and guilt-free. Innocent. They were called Pete and Johnny's. You know the name... Names of the two founders? Pat and Harry. To this day, I do not get it. Call yourself Pat and Harry, not Pete and Johnny. So we just said, it was great. We just go, oh, they're fake smoothies from fake people. We're pretty ruthless, yeah. But it was just a massive own goal. Why make up? You know, don't lie, don't pretend, you know. Or only a bit.
Okay, on that very, very thought-provoking and funny piece of advice, I'm going to ask that we draw things to a close here. So, we know that Richard went to Cambridge, but we thought that, you know, Richard told me earlier that his house is still packed full of innocent products. So I'm picturing you in your home, and I think an innocent smoothie would look great in an LSE mug first thing in the morning.
Venus.
So, thank you. Please join me. That was a wonderful, wonderful event. Such a great lecture. Thank you very much, Richard. Please join me and thank you.